and give you an idea of what's going on that's interesting in that area. The field has changed somewhat in the sense that in the past, BBN was used predominantly to get an estimate of the baryon to photon ratio, or the baryon density as a whole, using the light element observations. And there you would take a given element or a given set of elements and try to get concordance by getting the same value of the baryon density. That's changed to a large extent because there's no way that BBN or the light element abundances themselves can get anywhere near as an accurate estimate of the baryon density as you can get from the microwave background. And so now what you can do is use the microwave background, and then particularly the value from WMAP, to get the baryon density. And once you have that, once you have the baryon density, then BBN effectively, the standard model of BBN, is now a dimension-free parameter, a dimension-free theory. In the past, we used to always talk about three unknown parameters, the baryon density being one of them. The neutron mean life was another one. That's now very well determined experimentally. And the number of neutrino flavors, for example, or number of relativistic species being another. But in the standard model, and that, with that number of neutrino flavors being fixed at three, there's really nothing else. Baryon density is fixed from WMAP, and so nucleosynthesis is just run, and a set of predictions come out. And so those predictions now can be compared with the observations, and the elements that we look at would be deuterium, helium-4, and lithium-7. And so I'll go through a little bit about what the status of that concordance is with those elements and what the problems are. And particularly, as you'll see, we'll see a problem with the lithium-7 abundance, and I'll try and go through what that problem is and what are the various aspects or possibilities for resolving that problem. If there's any time left over, I'll get to some of the associated elements, lithium-6, beryllium, and boron, that are associated with cosmic ray nucleosynthesis. So this, I think everybody's seen, but we need one number from this, and that's the baryon density, which can be converted to the baryon to photon ratio here given in units of 10 to the minus 10. So this is from the 5-year MAP data, and so we get a value for eta, which is quite accurate. As I said, there was no way to ever get this kind of accuracy from the light element abundances alone. So we'll be using that as the measure. And just in case people are not any more familiar with BBN theory, I'll just give you a very brief rundown of the key events. BBN starts at a high temperature, at least for some standards it's a high temperature. Temperature is bigger than an MeV. And the universe's radiation dominated that period, and the contents of the universe in the standard model are just photons, electrons, positrons, and neutrinos. And the baryon density is now fixed at 6 times 10 to the minus 10. So in the early universe, we're in a situation where we have equilibrium at high temperatures, and that equilibrium that we're interested in is beta equilibrium. So what we want to look at are the distributions of neutrons and protons, and those are kept in equilibrium at temperatures bigger than about an MeV. At some point, because of the expansion of the universe and the way the expansion rate and the weak interaction rate scale with temperature, eventually those interactions fall out of equilibrium. And at that point, the neutron to proton ratio becomes relatively fixed. So it's a little bit less than one because in equilibrium, you have the Boltzmann suppression factor. Even though the neutron-proton masses are very similar, you're a little bit below that mass difference, and the neutron to proton ratio is about a sixth at freeze-out. Now, nucleosynthesis doesn't start right away at that point, as you'll see in a minute, and since neutrons aren't stable, then you have some more neutron decays, free neutron decays, which will eventually drive that number a little bit lower. So why is nucleosynthesis delayed? It's delayed because there are a lot of photons in the universe, and even though you're already at a temperature which is below the binding energy of deuterium, which would be the first link in the nucleosynthetic chain, so looking at P plus N going into a deuteron plus a photon, you want to compare the production rates and the destruction rates, and eventually when the destruction rate falls below the production rate, nucleosynthesis will start. And that doesn't happen until you get down to about a tenth of an MeV. So even though the binding energy of deuterium is about 2 MeV, the sheer number of photons present in the radiation-dominated universe, you can go out in that exponential tail of the photon distribution, there will still be plenty of photons with energy sufficient to destroy deuterium until you get down to about a tenth of an MeV. At that point, nucleosynthesis goes very rapidly. To first approximation, all the neutrons present at that time go into helium-4. You can just do the counting then and compute the helium-4 abundance, and you'll get about 25%. And as you'll see, that's actually an extremely good estimate. The rest all dribble out into deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7, which are down the level of about 10 to the minus 5 for deuterium and helium-3, and 10 to the minus 10 for lithium-7. Now, there are a lot of reactions that are in most codes. There are about 11 or 12 of them that are most important. They're usually signified as most important. They all have various uncertainties associated with them. Some are better than others. You have to be a little bit careful with these plots because you have to look at the scale. Some of them, the scale is very fine, and even though the scatter looks large, like in panel C, that is one of the better determined reactions. It's been improved in comparison with, for example, panel B, where the scale is quite large and logarithmic. So one uses the available data on the nuclear reactions, puts that into a code, and then get out a set of predictions, which here are parameterized by the baryon to photon ratio or the baryon density. And so what's plotted is the top is the helium-4 abundance by mass. So you see you get typically 23 to 25% by mass. The rest are shown by number. Deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7 by number as a function of eta. On the right, you just see the uncertainty that's derived from the uncertainty directly from the nuclear cross-sections. As I said, the helium-3 alpha reaction has recently been improved, so that lithium band should be a little bit thinner than I'm showing here. Okay. The thickness of the helium band, for example, is almost now entirely determined by the neutron mean life, and on the right you see that that's essentially, at least on this scale, there's no real uncertainty to speak of anymore there. So here I plot just the same plot, but now showing the WMAP prediction for, or determination for, the baryon density, so that's the 6.2 times 10 to the minus 10 with that uncertainty, the residual uncertainty from WMAP, and now you can see you can just essentially use your nucleosynthesis calculation and predict the primordial abundances of the elements. They're just where those curves cross. So you get very definite predictions, and now the challenge is to go out and match that with the observations. So where the observations come from are from a wide variety of environments throughout the universe, starting with helium-4 is observed in extragalactic H2 regions, so regions of ionized hydrogen gas in other galaxies, typically small, irregular galaxies. That abundance is about 25% by mass, as I said. Lithium is observed in our own galaxy in the atmospheres of old halo stars, small stars that are present in our own galaxy. Very metal-poor stars, so the oldest stars that we find, and that abundance is about 10 to the minus 10. Deuterium is best observed in quasar absorption systems, so that's looking along the line of sight towards a quasar. The light emitted from the quasar passes through a number of hydrogen absorption clouds, and from that it is sometimes possible to pick out the deuterium abundance as a shift from the hydrogen. And it's also observed locally in the interstellar medium. It's observed, its abundance can be inferred in other ways for solar system abundances. But the most important here is the quasar absorption system because they are at high redshift and they put you back at a time closest to the Big Bang that's available for abundance measurements. Helium-3 I won't talk about. There are a lot of measurements of helium-3, but the history of helium-3 is very uncertain. We don't know if helium-3 is created in net by stars or destroyed in net by stars, and so it's very hard to take any given observation of helium-3 and trace it back to a Big Bang abundance. I won't say anything more about helium-3. So deuterium, first of all, is hopefully you know that all the deuterium that's observed in the universe is primordial. There are no known sources, astrophysics sources, for the production of deuterium in net quantities. And so deuterium is just destroyed as the universe evolves, as the material passes through stars. As I said, it is observed locally, but those measurements now are in principle already depleted from the primordial abundances. and they're observed in quasar absorption systems. Now, there aren't very many of these systems in which deuterium has been observed. In fact, there's only about 7 of them with reliable deuterium abundance measurements, and those are shown here. In fact, one of them is relatively new. This one here is just released within the last couple of months or so. And it depends how you read this. It's either good or bad. I mean, it's good because they're all between 2 and 4 times 10 to the minus 5. There are some of them that really do line up very nicely together, but there is quite a bit of dispersion in this data, and that dispersion is not understood. In principle, you would expect to see something like a plateau, which we'll see, for example, for lithium. You'd like to see something like a line for this. Probably these are just systematic uncertainties. It could be indicative of something more severe, but I think at this point it's probably safe to consider those as systematic uncertainties. The BBN prediction for deuterium is about 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5, and the average, just the weighted mean average of this data, is about 2.8 times 10 to the minus 5 with about 10% uncertainty. So as you see, those agree extremely well. Graphically, it looks something like this. The two bands here are for the deuterium abundance. That is, the tight one is really just the weighted mean average with its derived uncertainty. The other one is saying, well, if there are underlying systematics that are larger than the statistical uncertainties, let me expand that band. Either way, that's the range that you would get from deuterium for the baryon to photon ratio, and you can just add what WMAP gives, and that's great. The agreement there has been well known now for several years that the WMAP prediction for the baryon density and the one derived from deuterium are in excellent agreement. Okay, that's about as good as we're going to get, as you'll see as we go through the other elements. Helium-4, first thing to note is helium-4 is primordial. The helium-4 does show this nice plateau here. It's, of course, exaggerated, showing a plot between 0 and 1, but all the data line up. There are no observations of helium-4, which are substantially below this 23-24%. To obtain, these are, again, measurements in extragalactic H2 regions. They're plotted against the abundance of oxygen in those regions, the idea being that oxygen is produced by stars in those galaxies, and as you go down to zero oxygen abundance, you're getting closer and closer to the primordial abundance of helium-4. Some of the helium-4 observed in these objects was also produced by stars in the galaxy. So, this is what you would expect essentially for every other element. This is the nitrogen abundance plotted against the oxygen abundance for the same galaxies I showed earlier. Essentially every element except for helium and lithium would show this kind of behavior, whereas you go towards zero oxygen, you're also going towards zero of the other element, in this case nitrogen. That's because both elements have the same source, and that's stars in the galaxy. And for helium, it's quite different. This is the data of Isatov and Tuan. Showing a helium abundance of about 24%. The error that they quote is very small. That error is formally just the error in the intercept from the mean, and the mean is derived, from the regression here, and the regression is derived from a large number of data points from their observations. Evan Skillman and I have been quite critical about the error estimate on the primordial helium abundance. And I'll take you a little bit through that and what the underlying problem there is. The way this is done is that starting with a number of observations of the lines for emission intensities for helium and hydrogen, you're starting with determining what the underlying absorption for hydrogen and the reddening for hydrogen is. That is then used to normalize the helium lines. Helium lines are used then to determine self-consistently not only the helium abundance, but also the properties of the H2 region where the helium is found, the electron density, the optical depth, the temperature, and the underlying helium absorption as well. And what we found is that there are a lot of degeneracies in that method. And so as an example, let's just look at the bottom set of panels. These are helium abundance plotted as a function of the electron density or the underlying absorption. The method I just described would give you, say, the point, the central point here, and you see the associated error. The little points here are just derived from a Monte Carlo of the raw observations. And so each helium line, for example, comes with its own associated statistical error that could be then sampled through Monte Carlo, and each of these little black points are effectively as good as any other one. In particular, they're as good as that central point there. They all give a pretty much the same chi-squared that you would get. The mean of those points from the Monte Carlo that you get is actually not very different, but you see that the error is actually quite a bit different. So each individual point, the uncertainty is underestimated by the direct method and is probably better sampled by the Monte Carlo method. On top of that, most of the data points are not actually of high enough quality to actually use these kind of methods. And really, out of that data, that we found that there were only about 7 helium observations which satisfy all of the constraints in terms of what we would consider as high quality data. And here again, that this is, some of these are very exaggerated, but here you see the original point from Isotov and Tuan and our error derived from the Monte Carlo. There's a huge difference. Not all of them are anywhere near this big, but the end result is that if we were just sampling the error, the uncertainty in the intercept, we would find it to be considerably larger. We're trying to extend now this self-consistent approach to include helium and hydrogen at the same time. The idea is, hopefully we could break the degeneracy in the Monte Carlo and hope that we don't introduce any new degeneracies. Preliminary results showing that the final abundance is going to be more or less the same. The helium-4 prediction from BBN is just a little under 25%. Essentially no error there, given the WMAP uncertainty and the neutron lifetime uncertainty. The data regression, as I said, gives you something very close to that with a very large error bar. The regression could be argued as not being altogether reliable if you just want it, since there's only 7 points there. If you want to take the mean of that data, that's fine too, and you get something that's entirely consistent as well. So this is what the helium abundance gives you, and that's, of course, what MAP gives you. So it's fine. There's nothing to worry about other than the fact that you should be a little bit concerned that we don't know how to determine the helium abundance to the kind of accuracy that we need. Certainly get the helium abundance. We get it to around 25%. But to get it to the kind of accuracy that you need to test BBN is not there yet. So moving on to lithium. Lithium, as I said, was observed in halo stars in our own galaxy. Here's a plot of the lithium abundance. The units here, a little bit funny. This is the lithium abundance in units of 10 to the minus, it's log of the lithium abundance in units of 10 to the minus 12. So this is 2 is 10 to the minus 10. This is 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 9. Plotted as a function of the surface temperature of the star. So here what you're seeing is that for the hotter stars, where you expect the effect of convection to be minimal relative to the surface abundance of lithium, you see a relatively constant value of lithium emerging out. On the right, you see the lithium abundance plotted as a function of the iron abundance. That iron abundance, the units here are iron relative to the solar iron abundance. Again, log, so solar value is 0. This is a tenth, a hundredth of solar. And these are all for the relatively hot stars that are seen here, above 5,500 degrees. Again, once you get down to low metallicities, you see this plateau coming out, which was first discovered by the Spitz in 1982. There have been a lot of measurements of helium-4 over the years. They typically run around 1 to 2 times 10 to the minus 10. Some recent measurements have pushed it a little bit higher, but these are not the same field stars that most of the measurements are made, but are associated with globular clusters, so they're a little bit unique in that sense. Also uses a somewhat different method for determining the temperatures of the stars. Now, lithium also has its associated systematics. It depends on the surface temperature of the star quite sensitively. It depends on the surface gravity, on the metallicity. It depends on whether or not the surface abundance has been depleted. It depends on whether or not there's been any post-BBN processing of the elements. And so there are certainly strong systematics associated with lithium. Here's another example of the problem associated with lithium. This is the data from Ryan et al. Around just a little over 10 to the minus 10. Plotted again as a function of the iron abundance. We expect the lithium abundance to be increasing because of cosmic ray nucleosynthesis. Basically, alpha-alpha collisions throughout the galaxy, throughout the interstellar medium in the galaxy, over the history of the galaxy, will add to the lithium abundance. That addition comes up rather late, and so here we see we're matching the initial abundance. But the W map predicted value is the one that's sitting up here. And so that's the discrepancy. That's the lithium problem, that the BBN predicted abundance of lithium is about a factor of 3 times larger than the observations. So how do we get around this? Well, stellar depletion is one possibility. And the reason this is not usually a favorite option is because of the lack of dispersion of data. And so if I go back here, you see that the data are all very highly clustered. And depletion, so what I mean by depletion is that there are some astrophysical effects that are taking place in the star which are either burning the lithium or the lithium settling towards the interior, somehow depleting the surface abundance of lithium. And so what you would need is you would have to have some process which uniformly drops the lithium abundance by a factor of 3, independent of the properties of the star itself. That is, independent of the temperature, independent of the metallicity, independent of the rotational velocity, independent of all of the parameters associated with the star. And that's very unlikely that you would then get a very uniform abundance of lithium at the end. Okay, so that's one of the arguments against the dispersion. Of course, not foolproof if it was better understood. Lithium-6 abundance is sometimes observed in these stars. There are a few observations of that. And typically, when lithium-7 is depleted, lithium-6 is highly depleted. And so it would be very unlikely to observe lithium-6 in these stars. Okay. Standard models of depletion don't quite get you there. These aren't log units, but they can destroy and preserve the lack of dispersion in the data somewhat. You could say it's something to do with the nuclear rates, that there are some problems associated with the nuclear rates, that there have been some rates that are not typically ones that are involved in BBN that are very uncertain, and if the cross sections were very different from what has been supposed, then it would be in principle possible to drop the lithium abundance that way. Some of those have been tested and found to actually do the reverse. But in principle, a lot of these rates, all these rates are active, of course, in the sun as well, and so these rates can't be tampered very much without affecting the solar neutrino flux. And so it's very hard to get a substantial change in the nuclear rates and still get a reduction in the lithium abundance. Stellar parameters, as I said, there are systematics associated with lithium-7 abundance extraction. Here I show this is, again, in log units. So for the sensitivity to the surface gravity and the sensitivity to the temperature, so here, for 100-degree change in the surface temperature, you get 0.08 in the log change in the lithium abundance. So a hotter surface temperature would drive down the lithium abundance and get it closer to the BBN value. There was some excitement about this, and perhaps there still is. A few years ago, some new observations by Melendez and Ramirez, which actually indicated the fact that that some of these surface temperatures were systematically higher by a few hundred degrees. Their estimate of the lithium abundance was somewhat larger, a little bit over 2 × 10⁻¹⁰ with an error. This is the BBN prediction. And so now you're almost within 2 sigma. Not quite, but almost within 2 sigma. This is what their data looked relative to the Ryan et al. Data. So you see at low metallicities, you do have some temperatures which are about 400 to 500 degrees hotter. And that would give you a picture that looks something like that for the predicted abundance of lithium from BBN and then relative to those observations. So there's even with those temperatures scales, there's still a disagreement. Now, recently we've had a dedicated set of observations looking specifically for the trying to extract with another method the lithium-7 abundance using excitation energies in the atmospheres of these stars. And that seems to indicate temperatures which are cooler, that is closer towards the temperatures that were used in the past. This is the Melendez-Ramirez temperatures relative to these recent observations. And you see the Melendez-Ramirez are always a little bit hotter. And relative to the Ryan et al., they pretty much agree very well. And so that would drive the lithium abundance back down towards a level of just a little over 10⁻¹⁰, restoring that lithium problem by a factor of 3 or so. Particle decays in the early universe, now we're getting a little bit more exotic. Those were the standard astrophysical solutions, but we can go beyond that. And one of the more active areas in BVN has been the idea that particle decays around the time of nucleosynthesis or after nucleosynthesis could have affected the lithium abundance or all the light element abundances. And in particular, in this context, there was an idea by Karsten Jadamczyk several years ago that decays with lifetimes around about 1,000 seconds or so could actually destroy lithium-7. So this would be particle decays producing electromagnetic and hadronic energy input into the medium at that time would affect the element abundances. They could drive down the lithium-7 abundance and at the same time increase the lithium-6 abundance, and perhaps you could solve, I haven't talked about the lithium-6 problem or yet, but if I get there, this would also be a potential solution for that as well. That has received all sorts of attention because of an idea by Maxime Pospiloff, who noted that if we try and think of which particle in the early universe is actually decaying, well, always a good candidate would be something like a gravitino decaying into the lightest supersymmetric particle, or if the gravitino is dark matter, it could be the next lightest particle, which could either be the neutralino or the Stahl, which decays into the gravitino. In particular, if it's the Stahl, which is quite a likely picture if the gravitino is the dark matter, the Stahl would form bound states with helium-4. That bound state would allow you to catalyze the production of lithium-6, the normal lithium-6 production channel, helium-4 plus deuterium, is highly suppressed and would not be suppressed if the presence of these bound states were there. There's, if you had a Stahl present, these bound states would form, and lithium-6 would be produced in great abundance. Here I'm just showing a supersymmetric plane. The effect of the bound states on the left, the bound states are not included. The shaded region here, and this is the Gugino scalar mass plane, shaded region is where you get concordance with the light elements except for lithium. Lithium still has that same problem. And basically, the scale here is very exaggerated to what you might be used to. Normally, you would be looking in the region of relatively low Gugino or scalar masses down here. But this, in the Stahl region, which is below a dotted line, which is a little bit hard for me to see here. It's roughly about here. You have the Stahl NLSP. The gravitino here is relatively light. Almost over the whole plane here, the gravitino is the lightest supersymmetric particle. Those bound states essentially rule out all of this region at relatively low Gugino masses. You're pushed here. But there is an interesting region up here where you do solve both the lithium-6 and lithium-7 problems. Now, this is, again, at scales which are far beyond the reach of the LHC, but from the point of view of nucleosynthesis and at this point playing around, I think it's quite interesting. The last possibility that I'll discuss today is the idea that perhaps the fundamental constants were changed in the early universe. There will be a talk later in the week by Victor Flambaum who will discuss variable constants in a lot of detail. Here, I just note that in the early universe, you have you can set limits on all sorts of quantities, whether it's the number of neutrino flavors or particle masses or particle interactions. And just to remind you, that all came about from looking at the freeze-out, that is the equivalence of the weak interaction rates with the expansion rates. And that was used to determine the neutron to proton ratio at freeze-out. And so a change in any of the quantities up here, or any of the quantities that get buried up there, that might change either the expansion rate or the interaction rates, would then eventually have an effect on the freeze-out temperature and on the neutron to proton ratio, and for example, on the helium abundance. That's how limits on the number of neutrino flavors have always been set. In this context, if you change a fundamental parameter, and here what we did is looked at the possibility that all of the constants were being changed somewhat in a related way. So changes in alpha include changes in lambda QCD, changes in the Yukawa coupling, including changes in the Higgs expectation values. And then you consider those effects in a limited way, in the way that at least we can track them on, say, the neutron-proton mass differences. This is the way limits on alpha were always set using BBN, changes in the neutron mean life, and most importantly, as pointed out by Dmitriev and Flambaum, changes on the deuterium binding energy. And so, for example, if I use a relationship that the Yukawas and the gauge couplings are related in a very simple way, then I can track through all the changes in these three quantities in terms of the fine structure constant, where now I've buried all my uncertainties in a couple of key parameters. One R is the relationship between how lambda QCD changes relative to the fine structure constant. In a typical SU5 type gut, that number would be about 36, but is very sensitive to the particular grand unified theory that you're looking at. S is a measure for how fast the Higgs expectation value changes relative to the Yukawa couplings, and so again is in some sense a measure of fine tuning, and you can use things like electroweak symmetry breaking in supersymmetric models to get you an estimate for S. That number is on the order of 100 to 200, but again, very, very uncertain. So all the uncertainties here are buried in those two quantities. And what you find here, this is an estimate of the given a change in the Yukawa coupling, what happens to light element abundances, and you see that the effect is, there is an effect that if the Yukawa couplings, the change here, delta H over H, were on the order of a 10 to the minus 5 or so, you can get a drop in the lithium abundance at the same time, preserving deuterium and, to some extent, helium-4. The limits on this, in any case, even without solving the lithium problem, are, on the order of 10 to the minus 5. And so it is, in principle, possible with some changes in these quantities to get a change in the lithium abundance. And here I just show the dependence on these unknown parameters, S and R, and what values of these quantities you would need to solve this problem. So this is, again, a very exotic way of trying to get at the lithium problem. The lithium problem is either going to be resolved, I'm going to skip this part and go right to the summary. The lithium problem is either going to be solved by something strictly astrophysical, like the parameters associated with the lithium extraction, or something astrophysical like the lithium settling in the atmospheres of these stars, or it might be the fact that we have this discrepancy, a clue to new physics. That would, of course, be very exciting. At the beginning, it's going to look very exotic, whether it's particle decays in the early universe or whether it's variable constants in the early universe. We don't know. These are the issues that we have to address. Deuterium and helium-3 are more or less okay. That is, they agree, but there are systematics still both with deuterium and helium-3 that have to be resolved. But the lithium, there are two problems. I didn't get to the lithium-6 problem, but the lithium-7 problem is very stark at this point, and it begs a solution. I'll stop there.
Questions?
Thank you. So if Newton's constant was changing with time, would that have any effect in this lithium problem?
If Newton's constant?
Yes.
Usually, here, the way we've done it here is we've always gone to a frame where Newton's constant is fixed, so always into the Einstein frame. You could, of course, choose a different frame and start the problem that way, that is, start the standard model and just adjust Newton's constant. I don't think that will have a big effect on lithium abundance. You can set constraints, and people have done that, set constraints on, if you want, time variation of Newton's constant from the helium abundance, and those are usually on the order of a few percent or so.
Other questions?
It's a request. Could you say a few quick words about beryllium and boron?
Well, beryllium and boron are not produced in the early universe. Their abundances are very, very far down. And so the dominant source of beryllium and boron, as well as lithium-6, was always believed to be cosmic ray nucleosynthesis, so P's and alphas impending on the interstellar medium. And that works to a large extent, particularly for beryllium and boron. Lithium-6, it does not seem to work, because there seems to be data. Here's an example. A standard model for cosmic ray nucleosynthesis would do something like that. Lithium abundance seems to do something like this, and so one has to try and understand where the early lithium-6 comes from, in principle, if this was true, and you had some sort of, in this case, this is a model for cosmological cosmic rays producing lithium-6, they would also produce some sort of background of beryllium and boron at very low metallicities as well. But those observations really aren't there yet.
So I want to continue the question about the varying Newton's constant. So if when the limits are quoted on the limits on the Big Bang nucleosynthesis limits on delta G over G, are they including the uncertainty, the problem with the lithium? And
No, generally not.
Right. So if one includes that, so you've introduced the idea that constants might vary, and they might vary in some correlated way, and that might even include Newton's constant. So is there a bound? There must be another bound one can state on how much G can vary.
Yeah, you let me.
How much is it broadened is what I'd like
to
understand.
Let me go away. So here I'm showing limits on, for example, the Yukawa couplings, which are in fact the same as the limits on the fine structure constant. This assumes a correlation with lambda QCD. In this case, I have to hold something fixed, some mass scale fixed, otherwise I don't know what I'm talking about. So here we've chosen to hold G Newton or M Planck fixed. All the other mass scales now are measured relative to the Planck scale. Those limits, even if I satisfy those limits, I don't fix the lithium abundance. Those are not the bounds which fix the lithium abundance, okay? Because those bounds are just set supposing that I don't make lithium any worse. Just like when I showed you the particle decays, that shaded region didn't make lithium any worse. So for G Newton, the quoted bounds that you'll find in the literature also assume, I don't know if I don't think there's really much of a change directly on lithium abundance, but they certainly don't, those bounds, when you satisfy those bounds on G Newton, won't fix the lithium problem. Okay, they're just basically the bounds that you get for not screwing up the helium-4 abundance.
Okay, let's thank Keith again.